Meditation, karma, and the journey after death. The mantras that we were listening to are called the Trayambakam mantras or the Mahamrityunjaya mantras, and they're from a Vedic text called the Rudram. They're mantras that we're going to be practicing throughout the course, and this is a slightly free translation of what they mean. We worship the Three-Eyed Lord, Shiva, the auspicious one, who is the ground of being, with fragrant offerings into the sacred fire of consciousness. We ask that he free us from the grip of death, just the way that a cucumber is severed from the vine. Let us experience the nectar of immortality. This is a chant that has been in my backpack of practices for health, for chanting for people who are sick or after death. It's one of the most powerful chants there is in the Hindu tradition, especially in the Shaiva tradition. And I'm going to ask you guys to actually make an effort to learn it. Scott Schwenk, who is a great teacher of meditation and breathwork in Los Angeles, has very kindly made a sort of a practice audio for it, which you'll be able to download from the course website. And So it's my hope that we'll be able to chant it a few times during every class starting next week, and that you'll start to experience the incredible strength that this chant can give you, the strength that goes with the figure of Shiva, the yogi deity who is not just a deity, but a portal into consciousness itself. So I've been looking forward to this class for nearly a year. In fact, it came out of a very powerful set of contemplations that I found myself doing last January, in which I actually went through stage after stage of a kind of personal recapitulation, which at a certain point I realized is the kind of recapitulation that one does when facing death. So I found it incredibly freeing and incredibly potent, and it made me start contemplating actually working with you guys to begin to open up some of the practices, some of the contemplations, and some of the real deep opportunities that come to us when we begin contemplating death. My hope and my expectation is that what we'll be creating together is a living transmission of the pathways that help us navigate both the process of dying, the regions we enter after death, and the openings and opportunities that our life begins to reveal to us once we start to take dying seriously, even as a moment-to-moment practice. So in a couple of minutes, we'll chant our opening mantras and dedication, which are on the chanting sheet that appears on the course website, webpage. Tonight, we'll be chanting with a Shiva mantra that should be very familiar to you, and I'll say more about it in a minute. But the main thing that I'd like to start with is something that's in all the esoteric traditions that I know of, which is that the master key to confidently navigating the after-death realms has to do with your connection with a being who can serve as a conduit for the flow of uplifting grace. Whether we call such beings deities, gurus, ascended masters, ancestors, guides, Buddhas, saints, angels, or whether we call them Christ, Mother Mary, Gautama Buddha, Muhammad, these are beings whose energies protect us, enlighten us, uplift us, guide us at all the critical moments in life, and they are especially present and helpful and potent in the spaces that emerge during the crises that feel like death here in our earthly embodied lives, and that also are the real death that, as we'll discover, is not really a death, but a beginning. Some of these forms have unique power, and some of them are full avatars of the great mind itself, meaning that their forms can expand to reveal the total non-dual presence that some people call God. Shiva's yogi form, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, is one of those avatars, and he's especially associated with the power to liberate the soul at the time of death. One of Shiva's forms is as the universal teacher, who is not, again, he's not a separate individual, but actually an aspect of the great consciousness and of your consciousness and my consciousness that comes online as you awaken and become stronger and stronger as awakening deepens. And that inner teacher is one, whether we call him Shiva or we call her goddess or we give that presence one of the many, many names that the traditions offer their teachers, or whether we call that teacher by the name of the human being whom we have been fortunate enough to experience as a guru in our present life. It's the same one who has been the inner teacher for all of us for eternity, probably. And another thing about Shiva that is very significant for me and some of you is that he's the source of the lineage of Kashmir Shaivism, which is named after him. And these days, religious historians have discovered strong textual evidence that the esoteric tradition of Tibetan Buddhism was actually founded or actually comes from the teachings of Indian Shaiva yogis, who were the gurus of some of the founding Tibetans, who are now honored as the founders of contemporary lineages. And of course, for those of you who've been part of the goddess-centered communities that I've led over the years, Shiva is the inseparable masculine counterpart and the consort of the most powerful feminine forms, Kali, Durga, Lalita, the Mahavidyas, and the other tantric devis. Shiva and Shakti, Lalita and the form of her consort, Kameshwara, who's a form of Shiva, are often shown occupying two halves of the same light body. My guru used to say that Shiva is not a Hindu deity, and I also want to add to that that Shiva is not a masculine deity. Shiva is pure awareness love, the awareness love that underlies and gives rise to this universe of forms. Shiva is the stillness of pure being, always pulsating with Shakti, the dynamic power that rules cosmic and human creativity. And one of his names is Mrityunjaya, the conqueror of death. So this brings us back to the Mrityunjaya mantra and also to the fact that this course is really designed to make all of us into Mrityunjaya, into conquerors of death, or let's say beings who have befriended death and who can walk confidently through it, not only in the moment of dying and after, but also in life. So what we're going to be doing is creating, each of us, a core personal sadhana that will rest on some suggestions that I'm going to make, but because so many of you here are quite advanced practitioners, also will hopefully inspire you to collect what some people call the gold star practices that you have been working with for years and which you found most powerful for you. The practices you'll receive here in class and in the homework handouts are actually immediately helpful. They're not for some future time, they're for now. And every one of them has been chosen to help you in two ways. One, to help you in remaining undistracted, which most teachers of the death process tell us is really the main thing we want to shoot for as we prepare for dying. And the other is to invite grace, which is really the most important underpinning of whatever we do. And I even if you're very busy, and I know almost all of us are very busy, I'd like to invite you to commit yourself to at least two of the daily practices. One should be sitting meditation. The other should be a walking around practice, either a breath or a mantra. And one of the great supports for walking around practice is a 99-cent app that a lot of you might have discovered. It's called the Mindfulness Bell, and you can download it either to your Mac or your Android and set it up to ding at intervals during the day, reminding you to stop for a minute or two to take a mindful breath or say the mantra for two or three times, or just become super present to what's here right now. So let's start with a couple of deep breaths. Inhale with the intention to let the breath flow as far down into the core of the belly as possible. And exhale, pulling in the belly back towards the spine. inhale and exhale fully. And in the exhale, let go of the remnants of your day. Let go of distractions. Let go of whatever it is that you'd like to put aside for the next couple hours. And two more breaths. Inhaling, exhaling at your own pace. And let's take a moment now to welcome and open into the community that's present here. We're from 6 continents and about 20 time zones. Everyone here is a genuine practitioner. Some of you have been practicing for a long time. And that's very important for us because it means that the community that we're creating is a vortex that we're all going to be able to take refuge in during the time we're together. Some of you woke up in the middle of the night to be here live. Some of you are listening to the audio recording, and I want to remind you that the community, the vortex of this community, is just as present in the days and weeks and even years, I've discovered, after the live call as it is now. Imagine for a moment that you are sitting in a vast circle, a circle of several hundred beings, a circle that literally spreads around the planet. We're sitting around a virtual altar, an altar that's made of light, of awareness, and of our collective intention. If you're visual, imagine the altar. Imagine it as golden. Imagine it as filled with flowers. And imagine yourself lighting a candle and placing it in the center of the circle. If there's an intention that you have made for this class, you can offer that intention. If you've been going through a purification or some experiences of recapitulation, as I know many of you have in preparing for this class, you can also offer those. Place your right palm over the center of your chest, your left palm over your right, and bow into the circle. Bow to all of us who are present here, all of us who will be present in the future. Bow to the invisible beings who are here with us, asking that we be held and protected in the presence of our lineage masters and guardians, and in the profound grace of the great awareness whose insides are lined with love. Bow to yourself. We ask that our practice be of benefit to all those our lives touch. We ask that our practice be of benefit to our ancestral lineages, to our spiritual lineages, past and present, to all sentient beings living on this earth and beyond. And now we'll chant 3 times the invocation to Shiva, sung by Krishna Das, who will appear as a voice on our audio in just a few seconds, chanting this prayer that is also on your chanting sheets, asking and invoking the inner and outer presence of Shiva, the eternal teacher, who is radiance, who is presence, awareness, and bliss, who formlessly as light pervades all that is. Well, that wasn't Krishna Das, that was Wah, but how beautiful. Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Gurave, Satchitananda Murtaye, Nishprapanchaya Shantaya, Niralambaya Tejase. So, we'll jump in. Let's start with two radical truths. The first is that you're going to die. The second is that you can make a huge leap at the moment of death, and there are some powerful methodologies that let you do that. Death is probably the most creative and potentially transformative moment ever, and we're here to explore it over time, both physically and esoterically, and to do a deep dive into what it means to meet death with real agency, grace, and power. Woody Allen was absolutely wrong when he made that famous joke, that great crack, "I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." Because the truth is, you do want to be there, because dying is actually the most important thing you're going to do in your life. It's actually more important than your career, important as that is. It's more important than your marriage, as important as that is. It's even more important than being a parent. And, of course, the way you live your work life, your family life, your life with friends is also going to be part of how you die. And it is your destiny. This isn't our first rodeo, so in your heart, in your body, in your consciousness, you have had a lot of experience of what it means to die. And maybe some of you have had actual near-death experiences in this life. And I'm sure if you're anything like me, you've had a few moments that actually felt like you were dying. We have the internal wisdom to die not just gracefully, but creatively. And if we have the intention, the desire, and the willingness to do the work it takes to remain undistracted, to be open to grace, it could be the springboard to a whole new level of existence. And this is especially crucial now, not just because we're all going to die, but because we're facing some very tough realities as a species. And the way we handle our own destiny has an enormous effect on all of us. When we die, we're going to face those states that in Tibetan are called the bardos, the mental realms that we enter when the body falls away. Our experience in those states depends on the energetic resonance that we've been able to create in this life, and that resonance will determine what happens next, will draw experiences to us, very much including our next life, wherever and whatever it is. So preparation is really essential. One of my Buddhist friends likes to say reincarnation is both good news and bad news. The good news is that you get another chance, and the bad news is that you have no idea where you'll end up. Now, honestly, I'm a person who sometimes resorts to scare tactics to get myself to the mat, to get myself to take life seriously, and the possibilities of difficult rebirths are among the scariest contemplations that I know. The Buddhists, actually, who are really excel at scaring people straight, tell us that what it means to have a good birth, whether it's a birth into a subtle realm or a birth into another body, that a good birth is birth in what they call a precious human body. And the word precious is significant because what they mean by precious is not just any human birth, but a birth like yours, a birth like mine, a birth in which no matter how hard the circumstances of life might be, we have the opportunity to hear authentic spiritual wisdom, to take it to heart, to practice and study and choose positive thoughts and actions and cultivate wisdom and clear some of our difficult karmas. So this is what it means to have a precious human birth. And every one of you has done a lot to earn it. You've worked hard over many lifetimes to get here. And if you've read some of the Buddhist literature, mythological though much of it may be, a lot of it is filled with stories about what the actions are and what the gifts are that have allowed us to be in the position we're in now. The Buddha used to use the famous metaphor about the chances of getting such a birth. And here's how it goes. Many of you may know it. Imagine a turtle floating somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. Imagine that also floating in that ocean somewhere is a tire, a rubber inner tube, like we used to have when we blew up our tires, also floating in the water. Now, what are the odds of the turtle being able to poke his head up through the tire ring? Not that great, right? Our practice, especially the practices that we do here, give us way better odds than that and help us increase our odds. The way we do that is first by finding simple practices that we can do every day, not just when we're formally meditating, and learning how to stabilize our mind in those practices. Again, not just when we're formally meditating, but at other times. So a lot of the work we do in spiritual life is about remaining undistracted. And for those of us who are kind of ADD, and I'm one of those, there's also the fail-safe insurance of the presence of grace, which we can invoke, call out for, call out to, and which we're told, and in my experience, that it's not a fiction, which will be there for us. And so the incredible good fortune of a human birth like ours is also that we can prepare for dying and for the huge leaps and transformations that we can make there. So obviously we don't want to leave it to chance the way so many people do, especially in our cultures, especially in wealthy countries. And for sure, we don't want to pretend it's not going to happen. I know a lot of you know the line from the Mahabharata, the great Indian epic, in which one of the heroes, Yudhishthira, is asked, what is the greatest wonder in the world? And he, being a very smart guy, says, the greatest wonder is that every day we see people die, and somehow we think that we're the one person who's going to escape. I don't know about you, but I can go for years forgetting that one. Someone I met who works in hospice told me that she has met dozens of people who said after a terminal diagnosis, I didn't believe that this could happen to me. Really, it's a marvelous gift to be able to think about dying, not just to get your life in order in all the ways that we do on a practical basis, but also to really consider what it is that we can do to maximize the conditions and causes for a creative next phase. One reason for that, of course, is that none of us know what form our death will take or when it will happen. It could be really quick, as it was for my 27-year-old brother and his wife, a sharp swerve to avoid a dog crossing the highway, a crash, no time to do anything. It could be prolonged, as it was for my father, preceded by several months of physical pain and by profound disbelief that someone like him could actually undergo such suffering. And it could also be a deep exercise in letting go, in relaxing into dying, as it was to my friend Girija, not because her death was pain-free or even particularly comfortable, but because she had years of practice in working with her mind and opening to presence, such that the people around her said that at the time she left, she was surrounded by light. Part of what we'll be looking at here is tools on how to prepare for dying. We'll be looking very carefully at the basic practices we can do now. We'll be discussing kind of granularly what the traditions tell us about what happens after death. We'll discuss karma, and I'll offer you a protocol, which I hope we can do not only in class, we will do it in class, but also in between, called karma cleaning. That is profoundly effective anytime you have a charged moment, as well as being really powerful for past traumas. And we'll also discuss some of the practical aspects of what we do to prepare, because for many of us, it's much less scary when we approach death if we've given some thought to what we can do to, on a practical level, to make sure that we've tidied up. You know, and of course, in the last 40 years, a whole lot of books have come out that are intended to help us navigate the terrain of dying. Some provide maps, many of them based on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's groundbreaking work on the stages of dying. Some of them are about how to be with a dying person without losing your compassion or burning out. Others are about the practicalities of setting up yourself up for the end of life. You'll get a list of many books, including some of the traditional books that I've found really useful, and they all have bibliographies, so if you want to really go into the weeds here, you'll be able to do that, to follow threads into the issues that you're really concerned with. And also, there are many of you here who've been around a parent or a partner or a friend through this process, and I very much hope we'll hear from some of you. And there are some of you who I know are facing an imminent death process yourselves or learning to support a close person in their process. One of the main things we realize when we spend time with dying people is that the way we've prepared makes a huge difference. my father, whom I attended daily during the 3 months of his last illness, was in a lot of pain and fear during the process. In Kubler-Ross's language, he oscillated between denial, anger, and depression. And though he was a practicing Anglican and actually went to church every day, the pain of his cancer had upended his entire spiritual structure. I believed that, you know, being a practitioner, I should be able to help him to have conversations about the meaning of his life. But that never happened, other than a minute or two of recognizing some of the issues that had come up between us and, you know, him apologizing and me saying no problem. He really didn't want to admit that death was a possibility, and I didn't have the skill or the courage to break through his wall of denial. So I just sat with him, holding his hand, gossiping about this and that, silently repeating my mantra, and feeling inadequate, because you might recognize this if you've been with one of your parents, feeling inadequate because when the medication wasn't working and his pain was bad, he would say in a very small voice, "Help, help." And I didn't know how to help except by squeezing his hand and offering prayers. I actually believe the prayers worked to some extent, because one night, a few weeks after the pain had started to get really hard, he had a sudden stroke and died. A couple of years later, I got to sit with a man named Pat, who was an old student of my guru. He also had cancer. He'd had a liver transplant, and it was failing. He was heavily sedated and, in the end, in a coma. In most of the time I was with him, he couldn't speak or communicate. But the atmosphere around him was literally boiling with divine love, breathtakingly delicious. His practice and his devotion had called in such a profound level of grace that those of us who had the privilege of being there would be breathless with the experience. It was the first time I really realized what the sages mean when they say that death is sacred and that our practice helps us at death. But the main thing I saw was that death is not something we have to do alone, and that it's not something that depends on our ability to do something about it. They're guides, they're helpers, they're great beings who are available to us at this time. And if we have the ability to tune into their subtle presence and have called out to them throughout life, they'll accompany us through the dying process. One of the reasons I told that story is because there is not a model or test that we have to pass at death. I mean, we all hope for a peaceful, conscious, pain-free passing, maybe with friends and family or in front of our altar. But we're all going to have the death we have, and we'll die in our own unique way. It seems to me that there is no such thing as a, quote, right way to die. As I learned with my father, any ideas we have about death just get in the way of staying present with the dying you actually have. But I discovered with him and with my mother also and with other people that I didn't get to actually say goodbye to at the moment of death, because my father died in the middle of the night when I wasn't there. They're still around for a while, and a lot of things get resolved. And one of the things we discover when we have that ability to kind of feel the thinness of the veil, we see that they're actually generally okay. The good news is that even though there's a lot of great processes that can happen in the death journey, especially if we're able to be fully present, and even though the thoughts we're holding at the time of death have a lot of weight in the journey, all the traditions say that, that a powerful prayer or a mantra or, you know, or a giving into grace that you make or that the people who love you make, even though those ways of holding the mind at the time of death really have a lot of weight, as we'll see later, it's not the whole story, Because even if you happen to be sedated or shot, or if you die saying, oh, shit, doesn't mean you blew it. Especially if you have enough understanding to recognize what's happening, it seems to be very important to be able to recognize that you're dead, which is one of the reasons why we're often told by masters of this process that if we want to help our friends and loved ones who have recently died, one of the best things we can do is mentally reach out to them and tell them, you're dead now, move on, I love you, like that. The moments after death plunge us into the in-between state that the tantras call the madhya. The word madhya literally means center or space between. And if you've practiced with me or with another teacher or in another tradition, you have probably done a meditation on the space between one breath and another, or the space between one thought or another. And in these spaces, we're in direct contact with pure presence, pure mind, if only for a moment. So what we're told is that if we can extend these moments, and getting familiar with the madhya is the best present, the best preparation for death we can have, if we can extend these moments, they can become an open portal into pure presence, pure spaciousness, liberation. Let's find a posture and practice a simple madhya breath meditation. You can do this open-eyed if you happen to be in the car, but it's best to sit with your eyes closed and in an upright posture. And just start by attending to the breath. We start by being very present to the movement of the breath in the nostrils. It's a practice that in some Buddhist traditions is called shamatha, because it's all about pacifying and stabilizing the mind, and it's very simple, though not always easy. But we're going to do a slight variation. So as you follow the breath, see if you can begin to pay attention to the space at the end of the exhalation. Let the breath be soft, relaxed. It's just your attention that's focused. And as you become present to the breath, see if you can stop, if you can pause in the few seconds at the end of the exhalation. Just pause for as long as is comfortable, inhaling, allowing the exhalation to flow. Focusing at the end of the exhalation, pause, notice the space. And very naturally, let the inhalation arise. The exhalation arise. Pause. Pay attention at the end of the exhalation. Just let yourself ease into that practice, letting your focus settle more and more into that moment of pause. My guru used to say that that moment when the breath pauses at the end of the exhalation is the space of God. without making a big deal about it. Just see if you can get a felt sense in every moment of the presence and the pulsating stillness. At the end of the breath. Death is what happens when the exhalation goes out and doesn't come back. If you've been around dying people, you know that. So learning how to extend that pause, how to explore that pause, how to become stable enough in it so that it can start to reveal the depth of the madhya, the pure presence that lurks between breaths and in the mind between thoughts. It's probably the core preparation for that moment. Because apparently, at death, the madhya, the space of presence, reveals itself as radical radiance, and will talk more about that in the next class. As you taste that presence regularly, whether as a sense of ease or a feeling of expanding spaciousness, in meditation, you are experiencing what the text called the taste of samadhi that is there between every breath. Anytime you can expand it, you're getting a taste of the karma-free state that we enter in the time immediately after death. As in life, during the dying process, if you haven't practiced, you might touch the mudra very briefly, the way we normally do when we're breathing. You know, you're not aware of the space between the breaths during a normal breathing process. You have to actually sit and deliberately become aware of it. But what we're told is that if we have stability in our meditation, if we've learned how to surrender into that space, to actually become one with it, this is a moment where we can be liberated from all further births. And by the way, it's also in this life one of the openings through which we can do profound karma cleaning right now. What they also say is that if we miss that moment, we get several more chances. One of the experiences that we hear about in different languages, because different cultures seem to experience very different mental spaces after death, just as we do in life and in dreams. But what happens then is that we enter a world of light forms, which the masters tell us is very much like the world of dreams. It's what the Tibetans call the dharmata, the bardo of lights, the bardo of deities. And most of the Eastern traditions agree that the after-death world is like the dream world. And as we'll discover when we look later at some of the ways that the Western traditions and the literature on near-death experience tells us also, most of what we call near-death experiences, many of those, you know, those experiences of going through a tunnel of light, are actually examples of what it actually feels like to enter that dream state of this particular bardo. Just as dreams confront us with figures from our own unconscious, with our hidden desires and fears, and also with the regions of the collective unconscious that we may not have been aware of in waking life, but which are part of our mind, our mind space, the after-death world shows us the forms and substances that lie inside our mental body, inside our subtle body, inside our mind. And that's why the way we think and our core beliefs and the mental residue of the karmic imprints that we've created through this life and others have a lot to do with the way we experience the time after death. They have really a lot of consequence in the after-death realm. So, and the good news about this is that when you've lived a life of, you know, relative mental positivity and some degree of selflessness, the mental and emotional patterns that you've created will extend into death, which is perhaps one reason why the Dalai Lama stresses so much that famous statement that it's all about kindness, that his religion is kindness. And it's why, you know, what I call the Oprah practices of making gratitude lists and sending blessings are so effective and so powerful and so important. But in the esoteric traditions, there's also a clear recognition that our meditation practice can be used to set up significant pathways in the mind and in the subtle body that we can use to navigate the journey. Not just because our practices are creating impressions that take us higher and expanding our consciousness, but also because they are literally creating pathways. And some of those pathways are very, very available. So I want to just take a few minutes and tell you how my guru, Swami Muktananda, died. He was a person who, he had the ability, the siddhi, to know the time of his death. And it wasn't really a mystery because, as it turns out, if you really understand the sacred Indian practice of Jyotisha, astrology, you can see the times when you are most likely to die. And in his case, he had really researched it. I know this because I happened to be present at a couple of meetings with well-known Indian astrologers who pinpointed the period, which was about a week, when there was the biggest chance that he would pass on. The day before he departed, I went up to him and told him that I intended to go to Mumbai the next day we were in India to have a cyst removed from my eyelid. And he said kind of impatiently, "Don't go. The nurses here can take care of it." Well, of course, I knew the nurses couldn't. I knew I needed an operation. So my first thought was, does he want me to go blind? I was really quite annoyed. And I resolved the resistance that I was feeling very strongly only by reminding myself that the bottom line of the guru-disciple relationship is that if the guru tells you forcefully to do something, that as a disciple, you either do it or you can say you're not a disciple. So I stayed. And the next day, I ran into him a few times walking through the ashram where he would stop to greet everyone, really talking to people, hugging some people, very, very available. In the evening, he went to visit the woman he had chosen as his successor, and he told her a couple of things. The last thing he said was, "Never forget the Guru's grace." Then he went back to his room, lay down on his bed, and left his body. Just before he took his last breath, he rang the bell for his attendant, who got there 2 or 3 minutes later when the body was still warm. They were able to do the ritual that was part of his tradition, part of the way they prepare a great being for dying. They set his body upright on his meditation seat. They moved it into a cross-legged yogic asana so that the devotees in the ashram could come before him, see him, and pay their last respects as they would have done while he was alive. And then they rang all the bells in the ashram. It was midnight, to let us know that something important had happened. I was one of the first people to enter the room, and when I did, I was kind of in a dream state. I'd just woken up. And it took me a minute to realize he was dead. It wasn't just that he looked radiantly alive, but the power and the love that was radiating in his through his body was as powerful or more so than any time I'd ever been with him. And I stayed there pretty much full time for the next 2 days, meditating in front of him. And one of the things, of course, I recognized was that he'd made me stay back so that I would be there with him one last time before they put him in the ground. My guru was a profoundly disciplined and tidy man. He wanted to die, as he often told us, without giving trouble to anyone. He wanted to die alone. He wanted the people who loved him to have a chance to be there after the end. And he did his best in those and so many other ways to leave nothing to chance. So I'm not telling you this just because stories about high beings are encouraging and heartwarming. I'm partly telling you so that you can have a kind of darshan of his felt presence, but also as a way of introducing you to a series of practices that we can use to take us through the entire death process and beyond. There were three qualities he modeled in his life that also happened to be three of the qualities we need in dying. One was a total reliance on grace and devotion. The second was a radical willingness to let go, to accept what was, what is. After his death, we found that he had kept several letters from devotees, old devotees, in the top drawer of his desk. These weren't some of the thousands of letters of gratitude he received every year. They weren't stories about spiritual experiences. They were angry letters from people who had decided to leave him. And there is no doubt that he kept them as reminders of impermanence, as reminders of the ephemerality of all relationships, and as reminders of the importance of humility. So he had radical detachment. And that was probably the biggest thing he taught me. The third thing, the third quality in his practice was discipline. Absolute mastery of the pathways of transformation. Though he spent the last 15 years of his life as a guru, focused on awakening people, most of his life was devoted to traveling the pathways of the inner body. My guru was a very advanced yogi, and he really knew how to traverse the roots within the subtle body that let an advanced practitioner move up and down through the layers of astral sludge that ordinary people get trapped in, not only in life, but after death and into the higher worlds. He used to talk about this quite matter-of-factly. And I have to admit that in those days, I was much more interested in emotional purification in my personal relationship with him, not so interested in this esoteric higher worlds stuff. So I didn't quite apply what he was saying to myself at the time, partly because it seemed far-fetched for a regular person with unprocessed personal issues to experience it. But during the almost 40 years since, with a lot of spiritual practice and a lot of karmic processing, I've had enough experience to recognize that he was talking about something very real. And I've come to see that what this inner path through the bodies is about, and to realize that some of the practices I've been doing myself and teaching, as some of you know, for the last 15 years are, who knew, actually designed to help us leave the body in a way that can bring about a kind of miraculous transformation of the soul. Let's just take a little pause before we go into the main practice and be with the breath. Inhaling and exhaling. Letting yourself find the pause at the end of the exhalation. Letting yourself touch the madhya at the end of the exhalation. So I'm going to share with you what turns out to be one of the most esoteric practices of the tantric tradition, and I'm going to make a claim backed up by the tantric Tibetan practitioners that this is the basis of the fail-safe emergency yogic method for leaving the body with power and with the possibility of entering higher worlds. It's not the only method, and I'm only going to give you a piece of it for reasons that I'll explain later, mainly because it's not appropriate to do the whole thing before we're ready to leave. But it's one of the most direct, and familiarity with this practice is one reason that the great tantric travelers of the subtle realms are so confident when they approach their deaths. So here's the basic practice, and for some of you, it's quite basic, because we do it in nearly all my teleclasses. If you're new to the practice, it may feel a little elusive at first, but trust me, you're getting a transmission tonight, and it actually doesn't take that long to feel into it, if you're willing to take it seriously. And once you've found the flow, as it begins to marinate in your body, it really will open your entire energetic system. Find a posture where you can sit with your spine erect. This is definitely not a practice to do in the car. So if you're listening to this call in a vehicle or while walking, I'd suggest finding a way to sit or listening and then doing the practice later. Find the breath. And begin to inhale and exhale in a vertical pattern. Feel as though the inhalation is flowing in through your crown, as though the skull is soft and open. Inhale downward, inviting the inhalation to flow as deeply as possible towards the base of the spine. Exhale. And let the breath flow upwards through the center of the body, from the base up to the crown. Just follow the sweep of the vertical breath. And whenever a distracting thought arises, say to yourself, thinking, and come back to the process. And here, it's very powerful to add a mantra. You're very much invited to practice with a mantra that you are used to practicing with. And if you practice with a particular mantra, you'll probably find that it's going to come up on its own no matter what mantra you start with. But in honor of Lord Shiva and in honor of my guru, we're going to practice with the mantra Namah Shivaya, inhaling with Namah with the downward inhalation, Namah, posture of surrender and devotion, exhaling with Shivaya. See if you can feel the vibratory resonance of Namah flowing with the sweeping downward inhalation, maybe even emphasizing the sound at the end of Namah. And feel the vibratory resonance of Shivaya flowing with the upward breath. Ya, the last syllable of Shivaya, actually relates to the element of space, and it is a sound that very naturally allows the breath and your awareness to flow upward out the crown. Inhale with Namah, really letting yourself feel the resonance of the mantra as an energy that mingles with the resonance of the breath. Exhaling with the upward flow of Shivaya. And just let yourself settle in its flow. With the next inhalation, let the breath come into the heart with Namah. With the exhalation, feel that the heart expands with Shivaya. So as you allow yourself to flow into the next phase of our conversation, let your focus remain as much as possible in the heart. And I'd also like to invite you to very gently flow your hands upward, bringing your palms together over your head, and very slowly and gently feel that you create a subtle frame around your body, like an energetic bubble. Even perhaps bending over to include your feet. It's always very good at the end of a meditation in the Sahasrara to, I don't mean close the field, but just be aware of the energetic container that you can create around your body as you come back to so-called normal consciousness. Now, this is a terrific practice for opening your inner body in the day-to-day. There's a lot of depth to it. It's my daily practice. It focuses the mind. It can help you practice with an awake kundalini. It's tremendously effective in clearing the subtle karmas in your chakras, and you don't even have to focus on the chakras. This process will do it. If you combine it with a good diet, with yoga or Tai Chi, and with some skillful psychological work, it can be the basis for a steady and powerful expansion of your consciousness. So it's a really great practice. And it also happens to be one of the most important yogic techniques for leaving the body at death, because as you practice it, it trains you in literally lifting your personal consciousness at the time of death. So let me tell you what happens on the subtle level as the body starts to die. I'm not talking about the physical process, which we'll discuss next week. I'm talking about the esoteric process that both the Indian yogic traditions and the Tibetan yogic traditions tell us. It's esoteric, esoteric literally meaning inner. In other words, it's completely energetic. And we'll discuss the specifics of it over the next few weeks. Also, the physical analogs of it, the stuff that happens in the physical body. But I want to present it to you now, and for a few minutes we're going to do the 101 of the subtle body. So as most of you know from your studies of yoga, the subtle body of a human being is filled with channels. It's basically composed of channels, which are called nadis, nadi meaning tube or channel, that interweave throughout both the physical and the energy body and distribute life force or prana throughout it. And again, as most of you know, the most important channel is the one that runs along the center of the psycho-spiritual system in a subtle place along the path of the spinal column. It's not in the spinal column. It's because the spinal column is physical, and though we can... There's a kind of spinal breathing, which we can do moving into the, you know, by entering into the spinal column. This Sushumna Nadi is, I have found, best discovered by working with your attention just in front of the spinal column. It's called the Sushumna Nadi, which means essentially the channel of the auspicious mind. And Su means auspicious, Na means, refers to the mind, the manas. It's called auspicious mind because the Sushumna Nadi is the center within which your individual mind turns inside out and literally opens up to reveal its source, which, if you practice this for a while, you will know is actually a sensation of an inner opening into spaciousness that can in time become a full opening into what we call the great mind, the Dharmakaya mind. This happens often for advanced meditators, and it's actually the basis of most states of inner samadhi, or let's call it yoga samadhi. You know, there are different forms of samadhi, but for someone who does fundamental yogic meditation, there's an experience in which we can cultivate deliberately, but which also happens spontaneously, in which the breath stops, awareness goes inside, and the Sushumna Nadi opens. When we're cultivating it, I found that the best way to tune to it, to find it, is to imagine a vertical column like a wire or a pole, like a barber pole, or as one meditation teacher I know likes to say, like the trunk of a very slender birch tree, both of which are ideas that give us a sense of its flexibility. But it's, you know, you can also think of it as a kind of a staff. And there are many, many ways we can imagine it, and many ways we have spontaneous visions of it. There are actually layers in the Sushumna, which if you're a yoga geek, you can see in pictures and textbooks. And it's, of course, the thread that anchors the chakra system. And of course, as most of you know, each of the chakras, 6 in the Indian yogic system, 9 in the Tibetan system, is a multi-layered vortex of energies, many quite dense. And most of the dense energies that we experience in our chakras and which connect to what the yogic texts tell us are the karmic imprints in the Sushumna Nadi. Most of these dense energies are mental and emotional, but others have to do with our nervous system, including the experiences that our contemporary lifestyle creates in the nervous system, and they're impacted by issues arising from our diet, our body type, the toxicity that we take in, our musculoskeletal habits, physical trauma, emotional trauma, and the residue of the emotional energy that we've carried in this lifetime and other lifetimes, which are what we generally call the karmic imprints, the karmic baggage. Okay, this is the big sentence. When the body starts to fail, and we're talking here about the very last moments, the hours or moments before the end, the energetic resonances in our chakras begin to melt, to discharge into the central channel. The denser the energies in your chakra system, especially the emotional energies, the more they weigh you down, the more they weigh us down as we start to leave the body. The degree to which we've cleared and opened not only the inner body, but especially this channel, is the degree to which our energetic resonance can match the energetic resonance of the higher realms. So this is kind of the secret of the yogic approach to death, and it's so much related to what Kundalini actually does when it's awakened and moving in the Sushumna. So I'm going to say this again. The more we've cleared and opened the inner body, and especially the Sushumna Nadi, the more our energetic resonance can match the energies of the higher realms. When we've practiced the vertical breath process, especially when Kundalini is awake and unfolding, the more we practice lightening our emotional load, which we can do whether or not we have a palpably awake Kundalini, the more we've opened and purified our energy fields, especially our mental states. And if we combine this with yogic practices and mantra for opening and navigating the central channel, our pranic energy, along with our consciousness, will be able to rise naturally with the inner prana. And then when our last breaths begin to happen, those very, very noticeable final breaths, which we'll talk about next week, our consciousness is literally lifted with the subtle breath, the prana shakti, specifically the rising breath, the udana shakti, upward from the heart level through the level of the throat and into the region above the crown. This is the all-important moment when our ability to lift our consciousness and take the help of our teachers, and by this I mean the master teachers, whom some of us are fortunate enough to have in a physical form, but which all of us have access to in the subtle form. This is really true, and it's one of the reasons why connecting to a teacher or a deity and getting in the habit of asking for grace is so important. So let's just take a moment and breathe vertically. Breathing in and down, out and up. Again, I want to tell you that this information, which may or may not feel meaningful to you at this moment, is going to be meaningful to you at some point because it will be your experience. So what we call the individual soul is actually the individual mind stream, because all of this ultimately is one big mind. Your personal slice, so to speak, of the mind stream consists of your tendencies, your mental patterns, your patterns of behavior and their resonance, all of which are influenced by the karmic backpack that you've accumulated during this life and other lives, the practices you've done to purify your mind during this life, along with the power of your accumulated positive thoughts and actions, becomes part of the stream that helps your consciousness rise. Regrets are big. Anger, attachments, especially negative attachments, unreleased baggage, are like ballast that drag your consciousness down, but your habits of practice and the help you receive from friends, you know, literally peer friends who've done practice, and teachers, and the prayers of the people who love you, and the invisible guides, can help you rise even when there's emotional residue. And the rising breath, the udana prana, and the other breaths, the other winds, the other pranas that come into play here, will carry the soul through one of several openings. The Tibetans say there are 9 openings. The Hindus say pretty much the same thing, which correspond to the chakras. And they include the anus, the sexual organ, the navel region, the heart, the throat, the mouth, the ears, the eyes, the crown of the head. For most people who've lived fairly conscious lives, and that includes according to the testimony of people I know, that includes probably your parents, most of your friends who haven't done a lot of practice. For most people, the soul leaves through the eyes. And what that means, we'll talk about this later, is that you'll go through a particular realms of the after-death bardos, most of them pretty benign. And there are mythological descriptions of what they look like, and some that have come from masters who have passed on and left or channeled testimony about it. So some of you may have actually seen the soul leaving. You actually, if you're watching carefully, if you're with someone who's dying and you're watching carefully, this can feel like a kind of a subtle breeze that is a kind of a shimmer that comes out of the eyes. And I've also heard of practitioners who see it as a darting blue light that moves very fast out of the eyes, or in one case I've heard even through the crown. A teacher that I know who works with the Tibetan practices to help his mother die saw that blue light leaving through her eyes 2 hours before she took her last physical breath. If you've done the practices and if you have the guidance of a master, you can leave the body through the fontanelle, through the crown of the head. In cultivating this pathway, as you cultivate this pathway, this higher region will be light enough and open enough so that your consciousness will literally rise up out of the body and travel into regions of light. These are not heaven realms in the sense that esoteric religions describe. Actually, before I go on with this, let's do some practice. So find yourself a posture. And begin in a very easy and relaxed fashion to allow the breath to flow in through the crown. And with the inhalation, to allow it to flow down towards the base of the body. And then with the exhalation, feel the breath rising through the center of the body, moving through the belly, through the chest, up through the throat, up to the third eye, to the center of the head, and allow the breath to flow through the crown, with the inhalation, Namah. With the exhalation, Shivaya. With the inhalation, Namah. With the exhalation, Shivaya. Now we're going to add another piece of this practice, which is, again, for some of you, it will be familiar. For others, it will be new. But what we're doing now is just kind of beginning a process that will deepen and expand in the course of the class. This is the practice of that the Tibetans call Guru Yoga. It can also be done as Deity Yoga. And to begin, I'd like to ask you to bring to mind an enlightened master, one who's in the body, or one who is no longer in the body. It doesn't have to be someone you know. And for this particular version of the practice, it doesn't have to be someone whom you see in form. And this being can be a deity, it can be a goddess, it can be a form of Shiva, it can be Buddha, it can be Christ, it can be Mother Mary. For some of you, the figure, the being that comes to mind might be some hidden sage that you've come in contact with. I want you to feel that this being is seated above your crown. About 8 finger widths, though you don't have to be exact, above the crown. Perhaps if it's someone that you've seen, that you're familiar with, the image of that being may come very easily to mind. Just allow yourself to imagine this being present over your head. Again, it's really not necessary to have a firm visualization, just to have a feeling of that being's presence. As you do this practice on your own, it's also helpful to have a picture or a painting or a photograph. But for now, we're going to use the intuitive sensing of our own mind. As you inhale, feel that streams of grace and love, perhaps in the form of a golden light, perhaps simply as a feeling of presence, are flowing down through your crown, offered to you with enormous compassion and sweetness from this being. Feel it flowing in down towards the base of the body. And as the breath flows upwards, feel that whatever you're holding that is constricting or limiting is being offered up into the being above your head, where he or she will metabolize it into light and grace and love. Inhaling, feel the flow of grace in the form of golden light flowing from the being above exhaling, allow whatever arises to flow upward and be offered into that presence at your crown. Feel that the grace that flows from the being above you flows through your head, bathing your brain, flows down through your shoulders and chest, and begins to transfigure your body all the way to the feet. And as you exhale, feel that limitations, karmas, barriers flow upward and melt into the great light of this being above your head. Feel that the streams of grace that flow from this being are gentle, are loving, are meant not to flood you with radiance, but rather to comfort you, to gently open knots in your body, and to begin to show you what's possible. If a mantra comes, allow it. Otherwise, allow the sound of Namah Shivaya. Which really offers love and honor into the heart of consciousness itself. Allow that mantra to flow with the inhalation and to flow upward with the exhalation. Feel that the energy of this being above your crown dissolves into subtle particles of light. And if it feels right, feel these particles flowing down into your heart. Otherwise, you can simply offer thanks to this being and to all the energies that have surrounded and protected us during this meditation. And ask them to return to their abode in consciousness. And gently allow your arms to float up, bringing your palms together above your crown. And then very slowly draw the energetic bubble around yourself, arm's length distance, to each side, in front, behind. Imagining that a sphere of light surrounds your body, holding you, protecting you. And allowing the energies that have been opened in the higher regions of your awareness to gently flow down into your heart. So that the inhalation rises within the heart and the exhalation flows from the heart through the body. Every moment that we practice a meditation like this literally transfigures our subtle body, literally dissolves karmic patterns, literally prepares us for deeper and deeper experience of the light that we most deeply are. So these two practices which you're invited to cultivate combine two very powerful pathways that truly help us at the time of dying. The connection with and the cultivation of the presence of the holy beings, which may have felt dim for some of you, perhaps tentative, but which I promise you can be cultivated and opened. This practice of being present to a holy being, to a guru or deity being, is one of the great vehicles for becoming resonant with and calling out for grace. And the practice of learning how to be present in the central channel and to the mudya that is right there, the pause between the breath and within the inner body, is unbelievably profound for living and dying. And in the next week, as we practice the homework, which I'm going to be sending you, we'll look at what we might call the ethical mind training, emotional practices that are central to this process. And we'll begin a journaling process for those of you who are willing to begin now that will continue through the class, that can start to make us aware of what our intentions and hopes are, what the beliefs and concepts that we're ready to let go of might be, and to begin to contemplate what we might like to create for our future here and in the realms that can open up to us. One of the most powerful promises that the spiritual traditions offer us has to do with the existence of realms of grace and light that are, as we started to say, beyond the karmic realms of what we call samsara, the endless round of rebirth in bodies. Some of them are only for very advanced practitioners, but there are also realms that people like us can enter through grace and practice and connections with the helping beings that we've started to contact in our practice tonight. And these realms are described mythically, but they're not unreal. They're not just myths. In Buddhism, one of the main, it's called Pure Land Realms, is called Sukhavati, which literally means the realm of ease, presided over by a Buddha named Amitabha. In the Indian traditions, they're often associated with particular deities. There's Shiva Loka, there's Devi Loka. The Bhagavad Gita describes very beautifully one of those realms as the place where Krishna joins with those who love him after death. And there are certainly realms for Christian mystics and for Sufis. And these realms are not the temporary heaven realms or God realms that both the Indian and Buddhist traditions describe as places that we can go because of our merit, but which are temporary, from which we return to human lives and to lives in other forms. They are profoundly non-physical, and they're the stuff of myth. But they are places where practitioners live in profound satsang, where the energies are so light and so exalted that it's very easy to make spiritual progress. And they are also places where it's not only possible to complete your remaining karmic obligations, but where you also have a lot of effectiveness in helping others, especially the people working out their karmas on the earth plane. Some of you may have accessed these realms in meditation or in dreams. There are places where we can make such rapid spiritual progress that we actually can live in tremendous joy and a kind of radical purity of heart and mind. And I've come to believe that these realms are very possible, very open, and that setting our intention there, especially if we're willing to make the connections to grace that open the doors, this is very possible. And it's an exquisite outcome for practice. So we're going to bring our practice to a close this evening. You're going to be receiving a homework assignment. The audio will be available tomorrow on the course website, along with the pronunciation guide for the Mahamrityunjaya mantras. The listserv will be open, and I so encourage you to share experience and bring your questions. We will be having a question session, not this week, but the following week, a separate session, and also some sessions in these classes where you can ask questions and get them answered. So I'm profoundly grateful to all of you for being present here, for doing some practices that are pretty out there together, for being with us, and for everything that you do to make the lives of the people that you love and touch, to make their lives, the lives of your ancestors, and each other's lives, more brilliant, more holy, and much more fun. Thank you so much. Thank you, Deb. Have a beautiful evening. Good night. And Deb will play our opening mantras, the Mahamrityunjaya mantras, for a few moments as you depart.
Mukshiyamamritat. उर्वारुकमिव बन्धनात्।